I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Join me on a quest to find awe and wonder in all nature, human or wild, vast or small, encounters with creation that move us beyond words. In this episode, you'll get to meet Thomas Pearson. Tom is a thoughtful, measured, unassuming kind of guy who has been on quite a journey. It began with the birth of his second child, a daughter named Michaela. Knowing how this personal odyssey plays out, I can assure you that the ultimate outcome is warm, heartening, and life-affirming. But it began with feelings of sadness and grief. Tom, together with his loved ones, after an unanticipated curveball, moved forward day by day, sometimes feeling heavy emotion, but remaining open to whatever experiences and new life wisdom would transform their initial sorrow into joy.
When Michaela was born, she had just emerged into the world. She was Michaela, and she was beautiful. And I just remember holding her and just having her in my lap and bonding with her in those initial hours and thinking that it was amazing that I had a daughter.
Amazement, love, and bonding may well have been Tom's immediate reaction. But his next thoughts, while holding this new life barely entered into the world, were flickers of misgiving.
I don't think there was one particular thing. There were little signs. Her ears were a little bit smaller. When I first held her, she felt light to me, and that doesn't make sense because, of course, the infant is light. Nobody said anything. Like, in retrospect, the delivering physician and the nurses, they had their suspicions right away, but it wasn't like completely obvious to them. The nurse who was helping out afterwards seemed a little perturbed, right? Was not as jovial and friendly, but didn't say anything.
Michaela's parents, Tom and Tiffany, brought their newborn home from the hospital, and on that first night home, each parent, independent of the other, mulled over the same unspoken thought.
Neither of us had mentioned it, and once I had looked it up on my own, then I thought, oh my goodness, I think Michaela might have Down syndrome, and it's something that I had to share with Tiffany. And so I walked upstairs, and I walked into the bedroom, and she's sitting in bed and has her computer on her lap. And I looked at her screen, and she had also been looking up Down syndrome.
Thomas Pearson is author of An Ordinary Future, Margaret Mead, The Problem of Disability, and A Child Born Different. He's a professor of anthropology at the University of Wisconsin-Stout. That phrase, Down syndrome, displayed on Tiffany's computer screen, had never really been on these two parents' radar screen. As young parents of an older, healthy child, Tom and Tiffany had no special reason to consider such a scenario, but now here it was. A doctor's visit followed, a blood test, then several days of anxious waiting. Not religious, Tom says he now found himself praying.
I'm as agnostic as they come. But yeah, in that moment of deep crisis and uncertainty where you are facing something unexpected that feels like a tremendous challenge and hoping that it turns out differently, you know, I found myself pondering, also inwardly praying, right? But not in a serious sense, but more of not wanting to confront what I knew was to be true. You know, I recount that experience, that story in the book as a way to just underscore the sense of profound shift in my life that I was experiencing. Those days where we were waiting, it was disorienting. I was confronting emotions and expectations about my life. You know, I knew very little about Down syndrome at that point.
Tom's a scholar. No surprise then that while he waited for test results to come back, he plunged into research. And as he studied the history of Down syndrome, he was first struck by an aura of tragedy that has long hovered over it. He had already experienced a sense of tragedy, of course. And then he stumbled on the history of racial stigma also attached to the condition. For much of the 20th century, people with Down syndrome were called Mongoloid, as in associated with Mongolia. It's a term coined by John Langdon Down. That's the British physician after whom the condition is now named.
He was initially theorizing that, you know, what we now call Down syndrome was this kind of reversion to a primitive evolutionary state. In the context of the 19th century, these are very racialized ideas about human difference. He interpreted the features associated with Down syndrome, shape of the eyes, or the shape of the neck, you know, shorter stature, things like that. He was interpreting that through the lens of race and ethnicity, using the categories of the time, the so-called Mongolian features. So ideas about disability, about the condition that we now call Down syndrome, were very much entangled with ideas about human evolution, but also about racial difference.
It was later, and in the doctor's office, that Tom discovered comparisons to other primate species. For the first time, he heard the phrase simian crease.
I had never heard that phrase before, but it's a reference to just the number of creases in the palm of the hand. And people with Down syndrome have fewer creases or have one crease along the palm of the hand. And so this led to this notion of a so-called simian crease. In the early 20th century, this was compared to non-human primates that presumably also have a sort of distinctive single crease along the palm of the hand.
Taken loosely, the word simian pertains to apes and monkeys. The term simian crease is falling into disuse. Although it persists in informal usage, it's being replaced with the phrase single palmar crease. But Michaela's pediatrician did use the older term.
As the pediatrician was rattling off different signs of Down syndrome, she mentioned the simian crease. I think that was the idea of, oh, she doesn't clearly have this one distinct line in her palm that traditionally had been considered a feature of Down syndrome. And at the time, I was sort of taken aback by the implied comparison with non-human primates and had no idea where it came from, and looked at the palm of my own hand and trying to count the creases and looking at Michaela's.
Simian crease was not the only expression that Tom found himself weighing. He soon began wading into the racist backstory of terms such as mongoloid, mongoloidism, and even mongoloid idiocy. The field of anthropology itself, Tom says, emerged at least in part as a reaction against racial and cultural assumptions of the early 20th century. I'm talking about notions that put Westernness and whiteness in a position of privilege and supremacy. So, as an anthropologist, Tom had been trained to embrace different ways of being human. One of his core professional tenets was that human differences cannot necessarily be signs of wrongness or inferiority. And yet here he was, a professional anthropologist awaiting a diagnosis that would classify his newborn daughter using, inevitably, some clinical language of differentiation. Finally, after several nerve-wracking days, the blood test was in.
The doctor just said, "I'm sorry." And that was how she delivered the Down syndrome diagnosis. At that point, I just had this feeling of tremendous loss, as if someone had just told you that a loved one had died. And so it was just this profound grief that I felt. After that, it's kind of a blur. Tiffany tearing up and the pediatrician saying things like, I know, you did all the right things. So it was, yeah, it was an interesting experience. A blend of the pediatrician framing it as if she's delivering bad news, but also being reassuring. And this contributed to that sense of experiencing this as if something tragic had happened.
In the hours and days that followed, Tom experienced a swirl of conflicting emotion. Some of these feelings were very heavy.
My initial reaction was just profound stress. Difficult to sleep, kind of denial, but also wishing that it wouldn't be. These thoughts of not even wanting Michaela to survive those initial days. These sort of like dreadful thoughts that would like just streak through my consciousness. It's not like an overt death wish by any means, but it's like this rejection of this child.
I don't want this. I don't know what to do about this. There's other research that has documented this experience, right, where parents who are confronting a Down syndrome diagnosis for their child, it comes from a space of ignorance, of this sort of ingrained fear of disability or of difference that we've been conditioned to have.
At this point in our conversation, Tom stepped out of his story's sequence of events to reemphasize how personally painful his memory is to him now of his momentary rejection of Michaela, but also to say why he thinks it's important to share this.
Yeah, it's difficult in the book to recount this moment of the diagnosis and experiencing those feelings of rejection. And it's hard because of how deeply I love her. And so I think that my experience is not necessarily uncommon. And I wanted to share that so that other parents know that they're not alone. And if we put those feelings that we experience into context, historically, culturally, it helps us to unpack and come to terms with what are the different factors that are shaping our perceptions of the world, our misunderstanding of the world, of conditions like Down syndrome and things like that. And so I want to convey how profoundly I adore Michaela and wouldn't want things to be any different than it has been.
Still, that day in the doctor's office with the pediatrician's words, "I'm sorry," reverberating in his ears, Tom wandered outside in a daze. Tiffany stayed behind to take care of some paperwork inside. He got in his car and called his brother.
He's been a close friend and resource in my life, in many ways a confidant, and we're close in age, and he was the first person I told. And I could barely get the words out. I had texted him days before, and so he had been alerted to the possibility, and he expected me to be calling at some point, even though I hadn't indicated I would be. And he had done a little bit of research and talked to some friends that he knew who had a child with Down syndrome. And he talked about how normal it would be that I would coach her soccer team, that she and my son, Adric, who was a few years old at the time, would, you know, they would be great siblings and they would have a great life together. And up to that point, I had not even thought about anything being routine or typical. And so his just sort of talking about it as something that, yeah, it'll be fine, it'll be normal. That was the first time that I had even considered that.
And later I understand you called your mom.
Yeah, my mom, similar to my brother, in moments of so-called crisis, she's as grounded as they come. And she is immensely supportive, and it's amazing. My mom's preparation just had been her own life experiences as a mother, but also as someone who spent her career as a teacher in the special education field. The second that I called her, she could sense in the tone of my voice that something was going on. And when I had said, "Michaela has Down syndrome," she said, "So what?" But not in a dismissive way, in a like, "You can do this. This is not tragic. This is not a big deal. This is your daughter."
Concurrent then with his inner turmoil, calming messages kept coming his way, first from his brother, then from his mom. Additionally, he would benefit from insights from his own academic discipline of anthropology. Always the same gist.
What's a big deal? Down syndrome is not something to be afraid of. Try to understand that it's going to enrich your life. And it has. Parenting is challenging. I mean, anytime you have young kids, you never know what's around the corner. And there's just challenges and joys and stress and hardship and happiness and the whole range of experiences. And that's just inherent in the parenting experience. It's not something that is specific to Down syndrome in particular.
As Michaela grew and developed, Tom was able to corroborate by his own experience the wisdom of his brother and his mother. Life and emotions settled down. For Adric, Michaela's older brother, and eventually a younger sister, Zora, every step of the way has been unexceptional. Only the grown-ups went through that initial period of angst. For them, too, though, life with Michaela has proven to be normal.
I initially experienced those feelings of rejection and grief. But we never at any point
genuinely thought we would reject her. She was always our child, and I always knew that we would love her and she would be a part of our life. That was never in question. And within weeks, within months, we settle into the routines of parenting, and eventually Down syndrome sort of fades.
And I think her siblings, all they know is Michaela. They don't view her through the lens of disability. They don't view her as a child with Down syndrome. They just view her as their sister.
Why did I have those initial reactions to something in retrospect? It's not as big a deal as I thought it would be. So even though a lot has changed in recent decades, even the doctor who was delivering the diagnosis said, "I'm sorry." And then other people in my community, in my life, reacted the same way. We all want a certain life for our kids. We think, you know, we want life to unfold in a particular way. And it was a loss of that imagined future I was struggling to come to terms with. Assumptions about the future that I didn't realize that were even informing my expectations.
The doctor, as she confirmed Michaela's diagnosis for Tom and Tiffany, she also handed them a book. It contained a now classic essay by Emily Pearl Kingsley, who was a writer for Sesame Street and whose son Jason was born with Down syndrome. Over the years, Kingsley has become a prominent advocate for normalizing the condition. "Welcome to Holland" is the title of her short essay. She makes a simple point with a simple metaphor. After planning to go to Italy, you've unexpectedly arrived in Holland. So now what? Here's a taste of that essay.
"You must go out and buy new guidebooks, and you must learn a whole new language. And you will meet a whole new group of people you would never have met. It's just a different place. It's slower paced than Italy, less flashy than Italy. But after you've been there for a while and you catch your breath, you look around and you begin to notice that Holland has windmills. And Holland has tulips. Holland even has Rembrandts. If you spend your life mourning the fact that you didn't get to Italy, you may never be free to enjoy the very special, the very lovely things about Holland."
In that moment of coming to terms with the diagnosis and feeling the sense of like initial rejection, out of protest, I refused to read it at first.
In fact, it would be 5 years before Tom would circle back to reading that essay. And by that time, life had become so normal with Michaela, he no longer longed for Italy. And by the time he read Kingsley's essay, he had come to realize that a lot of people do end up in Holland one way or the other.
We're all in Holland. I mean, that's how life is. It's not just Down syndrome. It's not just having a child with a disability. Nobody can predict the future. There's always things that are unexpected or unbidden that come our way.
Thomas Pearson is author of An Ordinary Future, Margaret Mead, The Problem of Disability, and A Child Born Different. Coming up, we'll travel with Tom, Michaela, and Tiffany, not to Italy or Holland, but to a state fair. I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Several months after Michaela was born, the family went to the state fair. That's an iconic experience, especially in the American Midwest. But on this visit, even though surrounded by friendly crowds and with his family, Tom felt oddly lonely.
This is still 4, 5, 6 months after Michaela was born. Yes, I was still in this stage of coming to terms with being the father of a child with Down syndrome. It was a point where I had come to accept it, but it was still something that I was working through.
You know, I just recall not seeing anyone else with Down syndrome, right? And feeling like so alone at that point. These fairs, which today are these fun, joyous, innocuous activities, right? They have this complicated history. A couple generations ago, people were put on display as a way of trying to articulate who belongs and who doesn't, who's normal and who's abnormal.
You You may or may not be acquainted with this aspect of state fairs and large public exhibitions or expos. These events have a long history of judging things and people. Even today, obviously, fairs feature contest after contest, judging pies and preserves, pigs and cows. Here's a scene from the Iowa State Fair.
After trying all these apple butters, we have finally found our winner. It's a perfect product. Its consistency is absolutely ideal, not too runny and not too stiff. It's a beautiful color, and it, best of all, it tastes great, and it has a great aroma. So, the winner!
Now, I'm a passionate proponent of high-quality apple butter for every table in America. But some people have an unusual passion for perfection on this point, and you will find those people at a state fair. But that's just one of countless such scenes. Just a single booth at a state fair where judges size things up for adequacy and excellence, and, well, not just things.
Time for the coronation of the 56th queen of the greatest state fair in the country, the Iowa State Fair.
From Adair County, I'm Jill Wallace.
From Adams County, I'm Jasmine Wilborn.
From Almaquis County, I'm Kayla Noltine.
Back in the heyday of state and county fairs in the early 1900s, perfect livestock and perfect pickles and preserves went right along with perfect girls in evening gowns and tiaras. County, state, and world fairs were always about showcasing the best, including human genes. And then there were the baby contests.
The Ontario Argus, Ontario, Oregon, August 24th, 1916. The ladies of the Civic Improvement Club are very busy perfecting plans for the annual Better Babies Eugenic Test, which is to be held at Vail September 6th, 7th, and 8th. This is a popular yet scientific movement to ensure better babies and a better race. It consists of entering, examining, and awarding medals to children from 1 to 4 years of age on exactly the same basic principles as are applied to livestock at stock shows. Quality counts. Mere beauty does not count, as mental and physical development only are considered.
From around 1900 until after World War II, eugenics had penetrated American thought from the high-minded halls of the Ivy League to county fairgrounds. If better breeding could produce better apples or cows, why not better people? At state and world fairs in the 1890s, it was not uncommon to put so-called primitive humans on display, like animals in a zoo. In one notorious instance, decades after the abolition of slavery in 1904, an enslaved man whose village had been destroyed and family killed by brutal Belgian colonists was purchased in Africa from slave traders. The price was a pound of salt and a bolt of cloth. Otto Benga, that was his name. He was then shipped to the United States and put on display as a pygmy at the World Fair in St. Louis. He never got home again. For a while, he worked in a tobacco factory in Virginia. His tragic life ended in 1916 with suicide. When you and your family go to the Minnesota State Fair and there are contests to see who is the prize-winning chicken or the prize-winning pig or cow, you name it, this somehow is a cultural milieu in which you have a child born with Down syndrome. And then this whole question of what is normal and what is acceptable and what is desirable. Is it too much for me to infer that something like a beauty pageant and then a baby contest, that all of those that seem innocuous, at least superficially, are tied to this idea of pushing the human species towards a kind of perfection that the eugenicists were all about?
Yeah, exactly.
Attending the Minnesota State Fair, it became an entry point into exploring the history of anthropology, of putting people on display, of articulating sort of this division between normal and abnormal. I think when you look at the history of how ideas of race have emerged in American society, that is bound up with notions of disability.
Long after the most egregious state fair practices had faded away, the underlying cultural assumptions of eugenics still haunted the lives of disabled people and their families. This was true even in families that might have known better. In a moment, we'll hear about the little-known Down syndrome experience of a couple of world-famous 20th century social scientists. I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. We're speaking with Thomas Pearson. He's author of An Ordinary Future, Margaret Mead, The Problem of Disability, and A Child Born Different. Tom Pearson is an anthropology professor, so studying culture and values, well, those are right up his alley. But it was not until Michaela was several years old that he stumbled on an incident in the private lives and decisions of two famous social scientists of the 20th century. In 1944, a man who would become one of the most noted child psychologists of that era, Erik Erikson, called his famous anthropologist friend Margaret Mead for advice.
Academics are rarely famous, but Margaret Mead had taken on this public persona by the 1940s. You know, she had done this groundbreaking fieldwork in Samoa and other parts of the world, and she had written books that were widely read by a popular audience. And she was among this generation of anthropologists advocating for tolerance of diversity. We want to accept and understand culture, cultural difference on its own terms. So this is something that she represents even then, and she's really profoundly remembered for this today. You know, in the early 1940s, she's good friends with this other eminent intellectual figure, Erik Erikson, who maybe he's not as widely known as Margaret Mead, but by the 1960s and 70s, he was a really prominent public intellectual and has Pulitzer Prize winning books. So, you know, him and Margaret Mead are close friends. And in 1944, his son Neil is born. And as a story is recounted by Erikson's biographer, there were some medical complications during the pregnancy, during the childbirth. And Joan Erikson was under anesthesia when Neil entered into the world. And so the doctors consult with Erik Erikson, the father, and they tell him that Neil has mongolism, has Mongolian idiocy. These were the terms that were used in 1944. And they recommended that he send Neil to an institution, that he send him away. This was standard medical advice at the time. And part of it was that, you know, it would be too difficult to raise a child with so-called mongolism at home. You know, they would often say that there were health issues. He wasn't going to survive more than a couple years anyway. These were the things they would say, even though it wasn't necessarily based on a good medical understanding of the condition. It was just based on what was the prevailing, you know, logic at the time. And they also wanted to spare Joan the experience of having to bond with her newborn child. So they were pushing Erik to just remove Neil from his mother and send him away immediately. So Erik Erikson didn't know what to do. So he calls his good friend, Margaret Mead, who she's known for her work on childhood development, right? So Erik calls her and asks, what should I do? And she evidently advised him to institutionalize Neil based on the prevailing assumptions and logic of the time that she agreed with the doctors to send him away.
The prevailing wisdom that Tom is talking about was echoed by the most influential child care expert of the 20th century, Dr. Benjamin Spock. Dr. Spock just happened to have been Margaret Mead's pediatrician for her children, even before he too became famous. Here's how Spock later remembered and regretted advice he gave in his early career relative to Down syndrome.
When I made the diagnosis of mongolism in a newborn baby, I, like most pediatricians at that time, believed that I was giving the best possible help to the parents by advising them, if they could afford it, to place him at once in a nursing home, preferably without ever seeing him. This was on the theory that then they would not become painfully attached to him and would be better able to provide a cheerful atmosphere and plenty of attention to their subsequent children. As if anguish and guilt could be solved by trying to forget.
The pain and embarrassment in Dr. Spock's final words there is unmistakable. But Spock's regret drives home the fact that Margaret Mead's advice to Eric Erickson to institutionalize his son Neil fit hand in glove with the professional expertise of that time. It was years after Michaela's birth that Tom Pearson came across the details of this nearly forgotten exchange between Margaret Mead and Eric Erickson. Tom has COVID to thank for the discovery.
I was reading books that have been sitting on my nightstand for years, probably, and during the early months of the pandemic, the COVID-19 pandemic, when everything shut down and I suddenly had more time on my hands. And so I was just reading things that had been sitting around, and I was looking at kind of like the history of autism, and just came across this anecdote about Margaret Mead and Eric Erickson. For me, it was really startling because the idea that Margaret Mead, who is known for wanting to respect diversity in all its forms and celebrate human diversity in whatever shape and size, that the idea that she would advise Eric Erickson to send his son Neil to an institution that wasn't consistent with this idea of Margaret Mead and this respect for diversity, you know, that sort of prompted me to want to dig into, okay, what was going on in the context of the 1940s that would inform the ways in which people like Margaret Mead and Eric Erickson perceived what we now call Down syndrome and then disability more broadly.
Eugenics had boomed in popularity in the United States from the 19th century right up till, well, just after World War II. And that's when people suddenly began to realize that there were links between the claims of eugenics and the horrific consequences of a Nazi race theory.
One of the groups that was targeted in Nazi Germany in the 1930s was people with Down syndrome, people with disabilities, right? They were targeted for elimination because they were viewed as undesirable and inconsistent with this idea of the perfect body politic, the so-called Aryan race. These beliefs were not unique to Nazi Germany. These eugenic beliefs and attitudes were widespread in the United States as well at the time. Eugenics in the early 20th century was often embedded in policy and law and efforts to restrict who could marry who and institutions that were developed in order to house the unfit and undesirable, limits on immigration that were justified, right, in terms of wanting to put barriers around racially different groups from entering the United States. Like, so this was state policy, right? It was mandated from the top.
1944, the year of baby Neil's birth. Well, that was the last year before the full truth of the Nazi death camps came out, and we hope became a permanent part of our collective memory. What I'm saying here, trying to point out, is that it was the last year of any plausible deniability of the dire implications of eugenics.
It's in the 50s, 60s, and 70s that parents and others fought for inclusion, fought to keep their kids at home, to send them to school, to have them receive all the other privileges and benefits of full membership in society.
But it wasn't long after this public backlash against racial eugenics that the world saw the development of new technologies in the areas of obstetrics and gynecology. Technologies that carried significant implications for prenatal testing and intervention.
In the present, you know, it's more a question of the ways in which these attitudes manifest in personal choice. Through technologies like amniocentesis and prenatal testing, women are often in that position, right, of having to make that decision about who belongs and who doesn't. Technologies that began to emerge in the 60s and 70s and came into widespread use in the 1980s and 1990s. They have an important role, I think, in prenatal healthcare. But yeah, there's a lot of discussion of the ways in which they've been used to try to identify kids with Down syndrome.
In his book, Tom traces the arc of attitudes toward Down syndrome. We've already seen how the early phase of rejection was reflected in the Neil Erickson case, and we've noted how Dr. Benjamin Spock regretted his viewpoint and reversed it. That reversal was partly driven by the families of people with Down syndrome. The social trends behind this history that Tom narrates might be seen on a graph with two lines that intersect over time. On the one hand, as hard-edged eugenicists lost their clout after World War II, parents became less willing to institutionalize their offspring because of some supposed flaw or imperfection. In greater and greater numbers, they would bring these children home and fight to mainstream them. But over the same period, tools to diagnose Down syndrome prenatally came into widespread use. Now, children who were born with Down syndrome, like Michaela, were brought home with their families, but fewer and fewer of them were being born. In today's America, prenatal testing results in the abortion of upwards of 90% of prenatally diagnosed Down syndrome pregnancies. In Italy, the UK, Belgium, and Germany, the numbers are similar, and in Denmark, it's 97%. This trend was accelerating in the early 1980s when another now famous anthropologist encountered Down syndrome in a very personal and wrenching way. Her name is Raina Rapp, and she currently is based at New York University.
This contemporary anthropologist, Raina Rapp, who is well known today in the field, she recounts her own personal experiences in the 1980s, receiving amniocentesis, and after the fetus was diagnosed prenatally with Down syndrome, then her and her husband elected to not continue with the pregnancy. That was a very traumatic, life-changing experience for her, as she recounts. This then triggered her interest in wanting to document the experiences of other women who face the decision about whether or not to undergo amniocentesis and other forms of prenatal testing, and then why do some decide to terminate a fetus if it receives a diagnosis such as Down syndrome or some other condition? Why do others decide to continue, and so on? As a young graduate student, I recall attending a presentation by Raina Rapp in New York City, and I appreciated intellectually her research, and I knew she was this important figure, but it wasn't something that really meant much to me, as, you know, in my early 20s, not really contemplating parenthood, not really understanding these intersections that she was tracing in her work between things like reproduction, technology, disability, gender, and then all of those kind of questions. And I found myself grappling with through my own personal experience, very different than Raina Rapp's, but in some ways similar. What does it mean to be human? How do we define personhood? Who makes that decision regarding who belongs and who doesn't?
The question of what kinds of children are ideal or adequate now haunts prenatal medicine. The conflict plays out most obviously in how many boys and girls see the light of day. Sex ratios have been skewed in many parts of the world. By United Nations estimates, there are 140 million missing women worldwide. Women who statistically ought to have been born, but were not, due to sex selection among people who prefer sons. You've heard the expression, gone but not forgotten. Well, you might say that eugenics is now largely forgotten, but far from gone.
I don't think these screening technologies are inherently bad, and I think they have an important role to play. The bigger question is, what motivates people? And yeah, I think that a lot of people, their expectations for themselves, for their children, what they view as an ideal life, how they define things like accomplishment, this sort of urge to try to have the so-called perfect baby, all those values and expectations, those are shaped by culture, right? These are shaped by arbitrary norms and beliefs. I think a lot of people don't step back to question, like, what is motivating me to do this? At the time, I viewed Michaela's diagnosis as somehow tragic, but in retrospect, I didn't have to experience it like that. But I was manifesting all of these taken for granted beliefs about normalcy.
In our conversation with Tom Pearson, he used a phrase that was completely new to me, velvet eugenics. That term refers to using modern genetic science and testing and genetic engineering to reach toward perfection in our babies. Velvet eugenics, as a term, was coined by Rosemary Garland Thompson. She's an English professor at Emory University, but also a disability rights advocate and a bioethicist. Garland Thompson's point is that recent technologies have clouded the kinship between our contemporary prenatal interventions and the aims of early 20th century eugenicists.
People have different reasons for pursuing amniocentesis, but I have no doubt that many people are motivated by wanting to know whether or not their kid is quote unquote normal or their unborn baby, right? We cast some bodies and minds as abnormal and therefore undesirable. And then there's this sort of urge to want to reject that or even eliminate it. I think it's important to question that. That fixation on what we perceive as perfection, achievement or success, it sets us up for, I think, not coming to appreciate just the richness of the human experience.
Tom notes in his book that if Michaela had been born in 1944, she would have joined Neil Erickson in an institution. He's honest enough with himself to know that he would not have bucked the norms of that day. But even after Michaela was born, long after those norms had changed, the challenge of technology and choice hung over Tom and over his relationship with Tiffany.
Yeah, shortly after Michaela was born, you know, we were already facing questions, sometimes subtle, about whether or not we would have another child. And the doctor had commented about if we were to have more children, then we would be at an increased risk of having another child with Down syndrome. And it's sort of an odd thing to get days, weeks after you've had your second child, and they're sort of grappling with all these feelings and wondering if these questions are also a form of judgment about having a child with Down syndrome. And Tiffany and I are sitting in a restaurant weeks after Michaela was born, just talking about all these experiences. And I had made a comment about how if she were to get pregnant again, then we would have to have prenatal testing. And Tiffany just said, well, why is that? And I said, well, we'd have to know if it had Down syndrome. And she's, why is that? Well, so we could end the pregnancy. And I just sort of, it just came out thoughtlessly.
You actually said those words.
More or less. And I just, yeah, nonchalantly, like that's the thing you do. And Tiffany was just looking at me then with tears in her eyes, like, so what does that mean about Michaela? Because Michaela's sitting there with us in this restaurant. Does that mean you don't want Michaela? And I hadn't really like made those connections yet, that this sort of impulse to want to prenatally screen for conditions like Down syndrome and then the assumption that you should end a pregnancy with Down syndrome because it's undesirable. Like, what am I saying about my daughter sitting here next to me? Tiffany, she was so taken aback that I would just nonchalantly state that, right? Even though, I mean, as I mentioned in the book, Tiffany is supportive of abortion rights, as am I, and the rights of women to make decisions about their bodies. And we think that is important and value that. But yeah, when I had made that comment, just sort of nonchalantly, she didn't think she knew me anymore. As she put it, that was a low point in our relationship together, our journey together. And that was those early weeks, right, where I'm sort of grappling with the gravity of it all, right? Coming to terms with my reactions and the sense of guilt I was feeling about why I reacted a certain way and trying to make sense of it. Fast forward a few years when Tiffany is pregnant again with her third child. It was not really a planned pregnancy, but it just happened. And we're at a different stage, right, of our parenting experience. We've had Michaela now for a few years. Yeah, you have a kid with Down syndrome, but it's not this defining factor anymore, right? We've come to terms with it, deeply accepted Michaela, love and cherish her, and wouldn't want anything else. We wouldn't want any other child or life. And so, yeah, with our third, then we face this question, yeah, should we engage in prenatal testing? Like, this is what the doctors are recommending. It's what you're supposed to do. And we went and talked to one of the obstetricians, and they said, yeah, I mean, it's not really going to tell you anything about the health of the fetus. It just tell you how many chromosomes it has, but it's not going to change, you know, anything that we wouldn't be able to find out after it's born. There really wasn't a lot of a discussion at that point. We just opted not to do it. Tiffany didn't think it was important. I didn't really think it was important anymore. Regardless of how our third child was born, we knew that we would accept it into our lives. So yeah, our third child, Zora, was born. I just remember early after her birth, bringing Adric and Michaela to meet their sister for the first time and just seeing Michaela then hold her sister Zora in her lap. And it was just one of the most beautiful things.
So if we who are listening to you tell this story are going to really understand Michaela as a unique human being, as a little girl, rather than just a label or a cardboard cutout, I think we need to get to know her a little bit. Maybe a question like this could help a little bit here. What has she done lately that has maybe surprised you, something you didn't see coming?
Yeah, this past summer, she learned to ride a bike. She's been riding a bike for a few years, but with training wheels. You know, that's something I've loved doing with all of my kids, is going on bike rides, and have done that for years, pulling them in my bike trailer. And then as they have grown up and learned to ride their own bike, then they're riding independently. And Michaela is 8 years old now, and so she's been riding a bike with training wheels for a couple years. And this summer, I just decided, okay, we're going to try taking off the training wheels. And I didn't know what to expect. So we went to the playground at her elementary school, which just has a lot of open space, and it's all grass. So I figured, okay, she could ride on this. And if she falls, then, well, she won't hurt herself, right? Because she's falling in the grass. So I took the training wheels off, and then, you know, like you would with any kid, just tried to hold on to her and the bike and kind of walk alongside her. And then she just started riding, and she just took off. She hasn't looked back since, and we love going on bike rides together. And every time we go somewhere, it goes a little farther and just a little more, and it's amazing. So, you know, it's a symbol of independence. When you can ride a two-wheeler, you can travel further, and we all go together, and I think she really appreciates that and enjoys it.
And I understand she likes movies. Does she have any favorites?
Yeah, I mean, she cycles through them. The last few months, it's been the new animated Spider-Man movies. But this one has the Ghost Spider, which is a young teenage woman.
Gwen Stacy might be one of the top students at Horizon High. But when she's Ghost Spider, she's one of the coolest superheroes in the world.
She is just in love with that movie and with those characters, and likes to pretend to be Miles, Spider-Man, but also the Ghost Spider. And so she chose for her Halloween costume this year to be Spider-Gwen or the Ghost Spider.
Her brilliance and skill keeps villains at bay, and she's never afraid to leap in and lead the fight. When her DNA was affected...
You know, that's what a typical kid would do, is you watch a movie and then you do the role play to be that character.
Yeah, yeah. So she is often doing that, and sometimes we don't even realize that she's citing quotes from movies when it sort of has meaning to her or fits into a situation. And then later on, maybe I'll realize, oh yeah, that was something that someone said in a movie.
You took us to that scene in the hospital when Zora was first born. Michaela was just 2 years old, holding her new little sister sitting in the chair. How did the two of them get along now?
That's a great question. I think she loves being a big sister. You know, they play really well together, but they often compete as well, like most siblings do. They will often fight a lot together in a sibling way. One of the things that I think frustrates Michaela is that, you know, Zora is 6 years old and Michaela is eight. And to some extent, Zora is a little more trustworthy. You know, she can go outside and we know that we can trust Zora to like follow the rules. Whereas that's something that Michaela is still learning to do reliably. She can go outside for a little bit, but then we have to kind of be out there keeping an eye on her. And so she's starting to recognize that Zora has a little more independence than she does. And that is definitely a source of frustration, I think. There's a certain way in which parenting right now is just so mundane. Three kids, 6, 8, and 10, and they're all learning to be people, learning how to deal with stress and frustration and making friends and the challenges that come along with school and things like that. She's in no way exempt. Right now, we're just in this mode of, like, she goes to elementary school, she takes a bus in the morning, she's in gymnastics and in dance and doing all the things that a typical 8-year-old does. Michaela's younger sister, Zora, she's starting to see that sometimes Michaela needs more guidance or structure, and we've had to talk to Zora about that. But it's interesting because I don't think they really, at this point, it's not something that they're constantly thinking about. They don't view her through that lens necessarily. I'm curious to see what that will mean to them as they become older, and then at what point Michaela will begin to self-identify through those terms.
From episode to episode here on Constant Wonder, our quest often leads us to stories that convey the wonder and the beauty of humans being humane in this very imperfect world. For today, with this particular guest and this particular story, we're going to leave things right there at what is necessarily an inconclusive juncture in the story. After all, Michaela is young and has a whole life ahead of her yet. As Tom just described her, she's on the brink of coming to see herself on her own terms, yes, but also coming to see herself in the world that all too often will set terms for others. Tom says he's curious to see how Michaela grows through all of this. I've got a feeling that with parents like Tom and Tiffany, she's going to develop a healthy self-concept. She'll know how much she means to others and what the people she loves mean to her. Thomas Pearson is an anthropology professor at the University of Wisconsin-Stout. He's author of An Ordinary Future, Margaret Mead, The Problem of Disability and a Child Born Different. Today's episode was produced by Eric Schultzke with help from Brian Barba. Sound design was by James Call. Thanks for being with us. I'm Marcus Smith. Constant Wonder is a production of BYU Radio.